much. That's been challenging and moving. Would you be willing to take questions?
Of course I would. Can you still hear me? I'm happy to respond to any questions or comments. Then a cup of water.
One thing which has been at the back of my mind is why do we get into these situations? Are they universal themes? Is it because people are Christian that they're being persecuted? Are there other issues going on in the background as well?
Well, if you look at the main kinds of persecution in the world today are by the vast... Sorry, is this me crackling?
Yes.
If we look around the world today, are many people suffering persecution, but by far the vast majority are Christians. It's estimated in Paul Marshall, his book, Their Blood Cries Out, at least 250 million Christians are suffering some kind of persecution in the world today, ranging from intimidation and harassment. For example, the Coptic Christians in Egypt. I've got a question on the Coptic Christians in Egypt next week in the Lord's. So you get that kind of chronic, low-key, as it were, but very devastating persecution, right through to torture, imprisonment, and the kinds of killings which we've seen. The main sources of that persecution, to answer your question, some are still from residual communism, for example, China, or kind of a communist totalitarian state socialism like North Korea. I've been in North Korea, if you want to ask any questions about that. So you've got residual communism or centralized socialism of an extreme kind. Then you've got fundamentalist Hinduism, as we've just seen in Orissa State. But there's a fundamental difference between that and the other major source, increasingly now, of violence against Christians, which is militant, strategic, political Islam, is that the fundamentalist Hindus, okay, they killed, there are problems of forced conversion, there's a real need for prayer there. The persecution of Christians in North Korea is very intense, much need of prayer in China, but they don't have expansionist ideologies. They're persecuting the Christians where they are, but there is a real difference, is that part of your agenda is that with militant Islam, I mean, it's the vast majority of the world's Muslims, I must say this early on, because I've made some references to Islam already, the vast majority of the world's Muslims are peaceable, law-abiding, very hospitable people. I have some in the flat above me where I live in London. But there is an agenda of militant political Islam which is growing and which is a source of much of this persecution, particularly as tonight the places we visited, Sudan, that was an explicit jihad. I went to meet the leaders in Khartoum in the early days of the war. Always try to hear both points of view. I went and met al-Bashir, I met al-Turabi, the guru behind it, and they were talking quite explicitly about military jihad, about Islamization. They're not ashamed of it. They were quite open about it. And similarly in Nigeria, when they attack, it's a very explicit agenda. So the causes are different, and the results are a little bit different, but all need our prayer. Does that answer your question?
Thank you very much. Are there places in the world which have seen persecution, but where that persecution has now ended because of your intervention or the intervention of other people? In other words, are there also stories of hope?
You're getting it slim. It's slim already. Yes, there are, and I'm glad you asked that question because it's very important to think positive and to think what one can do towards reconciliation and towards healing. And the letter I wrote in the Times, I made a brief reference to this, but I had been down in Indonesia. Now, Indonesia is the world's largest Islamic nation, 220 million, and it has a very honorable record of religious tolerance and cultural diversity. And Christians have been allowed to settle and to flourish in many parts of Indonesia where they've chosen, like the Spice Islands, Sulawesi. Until 1999, when, again, militant Islamists, Laskar Jihad, arrived on the scene. And they came largely from the Middle East, from Afghanistan and Pakistan. And they were there in huge numbers. And I was down in Ambon alone when 4,000 to 5,000 jihad warriors were in Ambon. Many thousands of Christians perished. We didn't hear much about it until Bali. In Bali, when Australians were attacked, that hit the headlines. But there was a lot of killing and a lot of real suffering and displacement during about 4 years. But towards the, well, after that had been going on for about 4 years, the traditional Muslim leaders, the ones who lived peacefully with the Christians for a long time, and they wanted an end to this. It was difficult for them because they were under pressure from the militants. But they said they wanted some help. So had the great privilege of helping to establish an organization in Jakarta, capital of Indonesia. And the former president, and now the late former president, Abdulrahman Wahid of Indonesia, was our honorary president. And the organization has an endless name, which we couldn't make any shorter for diplomatic reasons, called the International Islamic Christian Organization for Reconciliation and Reconstruction, which mercifully abbreviates to ICOR, which we write in capitals, happens to go to 2 Corinthians, but that's by the by. Anyway, we set up that organization, and I was very pleased when shortly afterwards the British Foreign Office funded an interfaith delegation of the traditional Muslim leaders and the Christian leaders to come to Britain to work out the principles of reconciliation and reconstruction away from the conflict zone. They worked very hard, and it worked very well. When they went back to Ambon and violence began to erupt again, it was very quickly contained because of the literally good faith that had been developed away from the conflict zone. And I finished my letter at the Times last Thursday suggesting that maybe such a model might be relevant for the trouble spots of Nigeria today. Because when I was last in Nigeria and a lot of the killings had been taking place, I did meet some of the Muslim leaders, the emirs, as well as, of course, the Christian leaders, and they were very keen to try to contain this violence. So that is a happy story, and I hope it might be able to be replicated elsewhere. Does it? And that story is actually written about in here. But can I just tell you a very moving story as well, just while we think of the persecuted church, because that is a happy story. But one of the most inspiring moments I've ever had in my life was from that situation in Indonesia. And it was when the peace was beginning to try to be established. And in Sulawesi, this was not Nambon, there was a pastor called Reverend Demonic. And he'd worked so hard evacuating villages under attack and then trying to promote reconciliation. And always in those situations, you have people who don't want peace. I mean, their agenda is to continue the violence. And so he was framed and arrested and very much wanted, the church very much wanted an international parliamentary figure to be present at his trial. So I had the great privilege of going down against all security advice, but to the heart of Sulawesi to meet Reverend Demonic in prison and be present on the first day of his trial. And I met him in the prison on the Sunday afternoon, and we had a wonderful time of worship there. It was a horrific, smelly, dark, horrible place, which I wouldn't have wanted to spend more hours in than I could, but he made it radiant with love and worship. Next morning, went to the courtroom, and the three judges were sitting on the platform, and Reverend Demonic was standing just in front of them, alone, defenseless, except for the defense of the truth. And I will never, ever forget his words. He looked at the three judges and he said, "Your honors, I've been offered my freedom if I will plead guilty." He'd be a kind of plea bargaining. But he said, "But I cannot plead guilty because I am not guilty. I cannot accept freedom on the basis of a lie, even if I must spend years in prison, and I'd seen and smelt that prison. Even if I have to go to the scaffold, I would rather go to the scaffold for the truth than accept freedom for a lie." And hearing, just seeing this brave man just a few feet in front of me, possibly accepting the scaffold for the truth, I couldn't help but thinking of that wonderful verse in that hymn, "Though the cause of evil prosper, yet 'tis truth alone is strong, though her portion be the scaffold, and upon the throne be wrong. Yet that scaffold sways the future, and behind the dim unknown standeth God among the shadows, keeping watch above his own." What a privilege to be in the presence of a man who was choosing possibly the scaffold for the truth. Those are our heroes and heroines, and his story is also in this book. So there are amazing stories of inspiration and rays of light in those dark parts of the world.
Another question.
questions. Jean.
I wonder if you could tell us why we don't hear about some of these atrocities in the media. I remember when the Orissa thing blew up and I had an email out of nowhere about these people being massacred, and I thought, is this really true? Because I've never heard about this before, but is there an agenda?
I'm sure you could hear the question, why we don't hear. I mean, it's a question I often ask. It is extremely difficult to get stories of Christian persecution or any sort of Christian issues onto the secular media. And I don't know if you ever find this, but, for example, when I come out of Nigeria on previous visits, and I've got all the evidence and the photographs and the tragic stories of the killings and the devastation that's been wrought upon the Christian communities, the media do not want to touch it, or if they do touch it, they won't admit that it has a Christian dimension to it. They'll say it's political. They'll say it's local herdsmen or their conflicts over the land. They will not admit it, the reality of Christian persecution. And I think we have a very real, a spiritual warfare going on there, but we have a very strong strand of secularism and indeed, I would say, almost anti-Christian elements running right through our media. And there is a good friend of mine who does work in the media, and his name must be nameless. He works actually in TV, one of the main TV programs. And he is a Christian, but he said whenever he tries to raise anything that is Christian or get that on the agenda, he gets laughed out of court. The secular domination, I think, of the people who make the decisions in the media is something that is something we need to pray about, because it does mean it is extremely hard to get these stories out, and particularly to get anything out that has a label of Christian attached to it. If you do get it out, it'll usually be called political or something which does not acknowledge Christian persecution. I don't know if anyone would agree with me, but I mean, I've tried this again and again and again, and so often, the minute I mention Christian, they're not covering that story. So it's something really to pray about.
All at the back.
Perhaps the question is going to sit at the front next time.
You asked us to raise the question of Sharia law and the threat of it. You asked if we would raise a question about Sharia law.
Sharia law.
Can I build on that question? Where does the welcome and the tolerance that a Christian society, as we are, that could offer other faiths, become compromised? So perhaps set that in the context of the question of Sharia law.
First of all, the compromise is that we have allowed, it's one of the examples of compromise, Sharia law to come into this country with no parliamentary debate, no public discussion. And why am I worried about Sharia law? The reason I'm worried about Sharia law, not just myself, but Michael Nasir Ali, and if anyone ever reads any of the Barnabas Fund material, you'll know the concerns about Sharia law. It is any kind of Sharia law is inherently, fundamentally incompatible with the fundamental principles on which our democracy and our legal system are based, and as they've developed over the centuries. It takes back pre-Magna Carta, because Sharia law inherently denies equality for law, as between men and women, inherently denies equality before the law between Muslims and non-Muslims, and inherently denies freedom to choose and change religion. You can become a Muslim. If you wish to stop being a Muslim, it is apostasy, and Sharia law is very, very strong on the sin, the crime of apostasy. In countries like Pakistan, you can be killed for it. In this country, there are quite a few cases where Muslims have tried to convert to Christianity, and they've had to go into hiding, and their families have been intimidated, and even in this country, they've not been allowed to exercise that fundamental freedom. So we have within us now, in this country, a very challenging situation of two incompatible legal systems. And it's something that does need to be discussed. We need to consider its implications, and I'm particularly concerned with its implications for women. And I've asked questions about this in the House of Lords. For example, if a woman is married in one of the Sharia courts or tribunals or places where they operate their Sharia law, and her marriage is not legally registered with our British legal system, it's not a recognised marriage. I've asked this in the House of Lords, and I said, what happens to such a woman and her children if her husband divorces her, which you can do very easily in Islam? And there is no answer to that. They are totally vulnerable. So we have with us a very real issue that needs public discussion, public debate, not in a confrontational way, but it's an extremely serious issue. We have two incompatible legal systems. And that is just nonsensical and very serious, particularly for the women. And it's also associated to some extent with an increase in honor-related violence, because that is, in the very close communities, is something that is also growing, cause for concern with the police, cause for concern with social workers, and is another issue. And there's been a very, thought-provoking and disturbing report by the Center for Social Cohesion on this whole complex of issues. So it is cause for concern, and it does need a lot of prayer, what we do about it. Canada had Sharia law, and I met they actually got it withdrawn. And I met a Canadian parliamentarian the other day and said, how was it that having had Sharia law, it was then, proscribed? And he said, well, we asked the women. And I've asked this question again in the House of Lords. I've said to the government minister, is Sharia law in this country? Have you had full consultation with the women? So it's an issue. But it does mean that in those countries where there is Sharia law and where people really do suffer, and Christians in Pakistan particularly are suffering like at the sharp end of a fully imposed Sharia law, they feel that when we allowed it into Britain, then we were compromising them in many respects. And Bishop Ben was really shattered when Sharia law came into Britain because they're trying to stop it in Plateau State. So it is a big issue. It needs a lot of prayer. Does that make sense? No. In what way?
I think we ought to take a clearer stand in this country as Christians against the imposition of Islam on us here in this country. If you're traveling abroad, you cannot go to several Muslim countries and even take a Bible with you. And yet we let them build enormous mosques in our royal parks continuously, all the time, and we do nothing about it. And our church membership in this country is declining. It seems to me we ought to be doing more for ourselves and about ourselves here, before we worry too much about what's going on abroad, where we can't do very much. We used to, when we had an empire, we were able to allow people to live in peace together. But we've given it all back to them, and it's their country now. But I don't see why they should come here and start to impose their form of Islam on us.
You said rather more robustly what I was trying to say. So we should not have Sharia law in this country. So we agree on that. So when you say no, you're actually saying yes. We should be doing much more about it, and we should be speaking up. And I was actually very worried when our Archbishop of Canterbury, our present Archbishop of Canterbury, did agree, or did appear to acquiesce, put it like that. And I actually wrote a very robust op-ed article in the Church of England newspaper called, I think it was, Good Intentions, Disastrous Outcomes. And I highlighted there very clearly why Sharia law is unacceptable in a democracy. And it's why I wanted to raise it this evening to clarify that situation. We do have to wake up, speak up, speak out. The truth is uncomfortable, but we have to speak up and speak out and address these concerns. Don't put them under the carpet, but pray for a right Christian spiritual response here at home. And we are compromising our freedom. And that is a serious issue. Abroad, I would disagree with you a little bit.